This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Dr. Aaron Shunk is a biologist and geologist with a passion for nature and science. He co-founded Publici.com, a non-profit crowdfunding website which seeks to break down the walls of inaccessibility to science by providing an online forum to share and build science for people anywhere that the internet is available. He joins me now to discuss his work and the importance of science communication to the masses, and to also give us a sneak peek of his upcoming talk at TEDx Youth KL 2017, which is happening this Saturday. Welcome, Aaron. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So thank you for joining us. So Aaron, just to start off with, I was reading your bio online, and your undergraduate degree was in biology and education, and both your master's and PhD were in geology. Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so I started off in biology, and I wasn't exactly clear where I was going with that. And as part of my journey through education, I took a geology class, an invertebrate paleontology class. And here I was in the middle of the Midwest of the United States and the state of Indiana, and I had the opportunity to go out and look at some rocks that had these awesome fossils called trilobites. And I just realized how different the Earth was through time and how much you could learn by learning to read the rock record. And that started this passion. So then I switched, and I went and I got my master's in geology. And I was fortunate that a school was willing to basically give me a scholarship and pay for 1 year of geology undergrad classes. And then after that, I taught for a while at a university. And then I decided I wanted the PhD. So I went and I did my PhD in geology as well.
What was your PhD in?
Well, so it's geology would be the degree, but the subject matter I studied was paleoclimate, and I studied it from the perspective that paleoclimate represents an analogy for the outcome of global warming.
Okay.
And so the time frame I studied was about 5 million years ago, and that's an interesting time because it's before this ice age started. And so we think of both poles as having ice. 5 million years ago, the North Pole actually didn't have ice.
Mm-hmm.
So if global warming really were to take off in the next century or two, the idea is this kind of gives us hard data points of what might happen environmentally.
Are you still using that research in your current are you still focusing on that in your current work?
It's not the focus of my current work, but it's amazing. I'm currently an exploration geologist in oil and gas, and that's a paradox, admittedly.
I didn't want to say it, but you said it.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think actually the company I work for is very much so encourages green behavior, and we do use these same concepts. For example, Malaysia is a big oil and gas state. That's why I'm here in Malaysia. And what we're getting the gas from in Sarawak is ancient carbonate reefs that grew about 5 million years ago.
Okay.
And so these are now buried deep under the ocean floor, and they hold gas.
So how does your – well, if you could explain your work a little bit more.
Yeah. So as a geologist, what we do is we interpret seismic data.
Mm-hmm.
And seismic data, I think the easiest way to explain it would be like a sonograph for a pregnant woman, how you image the baby using sound waves.
Yep.
Very similar, but at a much bigger scale, we shoot sound waves or energy into the subsurface, and you can go down 10 kilometers, so very deep into the earth, and image. And then what a geologist does is goes through and tries to reconstruct different intervals of time. Of course, deeper rocks are older rocks, and shallower rocks are younger rocks. So the seafloor today represents today's time. But as you go down deeper, you're going through millions and millions of years. So as a geologist, we try to interpret the environment of each one of those intervals. And then using that information, we obviously are doing that for a reason in the oil and gas industry, which is to find economic hydrocarbons.
Okay. So just going on from what your bio online said, you also have an interest in pursuing scientific knowledge. And, you know, aside from the work that you do, you also co-founded Publici, which is, I quote, a nonprofit online crowdfunding website aimed at creating a scientific community without barriers and enhancing scientific education interactively. Did I get that right?
Sounds good, yes.
So could you tell me more about that? I mean, but before that, what got you interested in communication and communicating science and research?
Well, I think when I first started to get into science, which actually a little bit later in my life, I wasn't a kid that wanted to be a scientist. I found science later, and I realized science is a candle in the darkness. And what I mean by that is it helps direct and point society into a sustainable, long-term direction. Mm-hmm. And I see the benefits of science in the United States. And then I see a great pool of talent here in Malaysia that maybe doesn't have the same opportunity.
Okay.
And from that, I think the other co-founder, Fabian, and I, we realized, man, there's a lot of barriers and walls to people accessing science. And we thought, wow, there's just a great opportunity here to do something that can help spread science and help grow science. And so the two of us got together, and I have the more formal degrees. I have the PhD, and I've been a scientist. I've taught in a university. Fabian's a science enthusiast. And so the combination of these two perspectives, we realized we could get together and build something. So we've been working on this over a year now, trying to create this platform. And the platform is part like Facebook, where there's a community, but the community is like-minded people who prioritize science and want to learn science and communicate about science. But the platform certainly doesn't stop there. It also has the ability to share scientific knowledge. Mm-hmm. It has the ability to build science for yourself. And then it also has the ability to what we call a pre-pub, or allow you to put a scientific idea and actually get review and get thoughts on it. And then once maybe that matures a bit, then you could publish it.
So you said you've been going on for about a year now. And what is your community, as you call them? Who are they generally made up of? Is it mostly scientists? Do you have just like regular people like me with a slight interest?
Yeah, right now, we do have some scientists, myself included. but the bulk of people, what we find are the science enthusiasts.
Okay.
And that's really a great thing, because that's the spreading of science that we want. That's the getting people involved, getting them aware, teaching them the method. And I tell you, it's a beautiful thing here, because the people are really hungry. I mean, this is a place that loves science, and I love seeing that energy. I gave a talk here, and I was so impressed by the young kids and just their questions and their desire to learn. It was a really beautiful thing.
And, you know, I think, well, science obviously has a huge impact on humanity. And I remember reading an article a while ago which said that scientists and science communicators are engaged in a constant battle with ignorance. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that's
a fair comment.
Ignorance, of course, is the lack of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And science is always pushing knowledge. Yeah. But I think one important thing to realize about science is it's not a method of absolute knowledge, right? It's dynamic.
Yep.
I've read a study somewhere that says that in a textbook in the future, I think it was 20 years, half of that textbook will be rewritten.
Yeah.
And so
we see that with technology today. You
know? Yeah. So it's important to realize that science itself is dynamic. So I think you can't take science at any given point about any given subject and consider it an absolute. Mm-hmm. That's part of the scientific method, is dealing with uncertainty.
Right.
And the battle then comes in, people exploit that uncertainty, and from that they become merchants of doubt, is the name of a really nice documentary on it. But they sell that doubt to push forward their own agenda. And that's kind of the exploiting of the ignorant. Yeah.
I'm speaking to Dr. Aaron Shunk, a biologist and geologist and co-founder of the online forum Publici. And after this quick break, we will tackle the delicate science of communicating science research and findings to the masses. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Dr. Aaron Shunk is my guest for today. He is a biologist and geologist and co-founder of the online forum Publici. And we're discussing the need for scientists to be able to effectively communicate their knowledge and findings to the masses. You know, there's also the assumption that because scientists are experts in their field and that they think clearly, they are also naturally experts at communicating science to lay people and can communicate effectively. You know, have you found that to be always the case, or more often than not, or not at all?
I think it's across the board. Some of the most brilliant scientists, I think they're so capable of living in their own head, in their own imagination.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah.
That they've never actually practiced, and they don't have the skills to communicate some of their ideas. We've all had that professor in school. Well, maybe not all, but I have certainly had the professor in school that's got this incredible publication history, but is unable to communicate to the lay person. And that's a real challenge. And that's part of what, again, going back to the Publici model, bringing things down to everyone or the average reasonable person, there's a lot of value in that.
Yes, because public opinion as well, you know, that can help shape public policy. It can, you know, a lot of things come from that effective communication of what you guys know, essentially.
Very true. I think that's a very good point, is that science does influence policy.
And public spending.
Yeah, and budgets. And I think one of the things that science maybe needs to be more clear on is, assuming there's a fixed budget or a fixed pool of resources, where do you best spend those resources to solve a problem? Because I think it's the nature of every scientist to want to pursue their own funding.
Yes, of course.
And I don't think there's maybe that overarching perspective of what is best sometimes, what is best for solving this problem.
And how do you sort of tackle that? I mean, because, you know, each experiment is obviously considered relevant and important. You know, scientists obviously feel they need to present each piece of data. But, you know, generally a broader perspective, I think, is easier for, you know, somebody like me, a general audience, to digest and appreciate. So, you know, how do you sort of balance this in you know, your own writing, for example, on Publici?
Yeah, so I think the important thing is to differentiate your audience, know your audience. And if you're writing for peer review, the expectation is the people reading will be generally knowledgeable in the field, will have the vocabulary. If you're writing for the bigger audience, or if you're trying to relate to more people, you obviously want to define the terms that you don't make assumptions. You don't use the big words without explaining what they are. And you can't go into the details quite as much. You don't have the time to cover everything. So you have to stick to a few points and develop them and really, really focus on connecting the dots, because the people don't have that existing knowledge. So you have to build it. It has to be self-contained.
And, you know, you were talking about scientists. Obviously, they have their interests in their own fields, in their own topics, right? So how do they even start to think about making it more accessible and to focus on things that, I don't know, that people really need to know?
That's a good point. And I think I didn't ever become a tenure-tracked faculty, but I did deal with a lot of student grants and grants. But science takes money and funding. And it's interesting because most of the grants actually require that you relate it to the average person.
Yes.
And that's a part of it. How does this plug into society? And so asking yourself that question early and often is important. That said, sometimes, you know, building a multiple billion-dollar machine to slam protons together and see what comes out of it, there is no application right now, but the knowledge will lead to future things. So you've got to find that balance, you know, of what's good just for the sake of knowledge, and that is good for humanity, and what has a direct application. And I have to say, for my own personal research, doing global warming, there was a big pool of money. Mm-hmm. And relating to that really helped me get funding to do my research. So by having that social connection, it really made it a much easier path.
And you obviously had the formal science education. Do you receive formal training in science communication to the public at any point?
That's a good question. No, not really. I think there's outreach and opportunity for teaching. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's something they do coach on in universities. But the bigger the school and the better the reputation, the more important research is relative to teaching, I think.
Okay.
And so I think that is an area that they could improve for sure in the pedagogy of broadening and touching base with your main stakeholder, which is the general public.
Yeah. Do you think we should have then formal education, especially in this field, communication to the public?
Yes, I do. I think, but again, it's that you have a fixed budget of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And where does this rank? Obviously, because it's not currently there, it hasn't been deemed that important. That said, communication is huge. It's an absolutely must have, you know. Does every scientist need to be an excellent communicator, or is there the niche for Carl Sagan's and Brian Cox and, you know, these guys, Neil Tyson Degrassi and Bill Nye, the science guy?
That was exactly my next question. Who are the people who you think are the best science communicators?
Man? Well, the other thing is Carl Sagan is maybe an exception, but often the greatest communicators aren't necessarily the greatest scientists.
Exactly what I was going to ask.
It tells you something. They're different brains, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the best scientists I've been around, you know, they just think differently than you or I. And that's why they have this beautiful mind capable of doing things that end up original and new. But at the same time, they're so far in the bell curve of intelligence or whatever that they don't relate to the median in some cases. There are exceptions, though. My favorite, to answer your question, Richard Feynman is my favorite because he had it all, you know.
I'm sorry, I don't actually know who that is, but maybe
so
you can
he
tell
was
me
an American that. Physicist,
mm-hmm.
And he Feynman diagrams are these awesome diagrams that basically he won a Nobel Prize for turning physics equations into a cartoon.
Okay.
And it's not – that's not said to be demeaning of it. It's mm-hmm. to make something so complex that simple that adds so much value. And he was funny. He was known to play the bongos and, you know, just had a humor and was always playing jokes on other scientists. And, you know, he kind of started the – I think Carl Sagan kind of molded himself after him.
Okay.
And then, of course, Neil Tyson is following Carl Sagan. So there's this, like, kind of pedigree of being that representative. And he's my favorite because his research – I mean, he's the Nobel Prize winner of the group.
Okay.
And he was fantastic.
Some naysayers, shall we call them, said that most science communication isn't about persuading people. It's about self-affirmation for those already on the inside. Would you agree?
Everyone has an ego. And I am going to agree that although, I mean, my personal PhD advisor was one of these amazing guys that was seriously not very self-serving. But it's amazing the egos in science. And I'll tell you an interesting experience. My scientific role model, I'm not going to say his name, but he's like this super nerdy guy. He's got this incredible publication history, wears these thick, thick glasses and just walks around at this conference. And he is the superstar. You know, everyone knows who he is at this science conference and, you know, this AGU conference. And everyone's trying to talk to him, just get a minute, tell him, oh, I love this paper you wrote. You changed me, da, 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 da. And I was right there. And I got lucky we presented in the same section. And so I got a chance to talk to him, and it was exciting to me. It really was. But then we went out and happened to go to lunch, and just randomly, I walked into the same subway he was at.
Okay.
And he was in line ahead of me, and I was watching him from this other perspective. And it was unbelievable how different he was there in that environment. Like, he struggled to order, you know, and he was this eccentric guy and people were almost annoyed and like pushing him out of the way. And it was just this really eye-opening experience. The flip side of that, I've seen guys with egos so big that their science is self-serving, you know, they've become, and I'll say this guy's name. He actually turned me on to science greatly, but now after seeing more, and he's a famous scientist, no longer with us, but Stephen Jay Gould. I think he was so in love with his persona that maybe some of his work isn't standing the test of time. Some of the things he said, you know, are starting to fall by the wayside because he was willing to compromise the data to say what the masses wanted.
Oh.
And that's a scary thing.
That is very scary. Well, that is, that defeats the whole purpose, isn't it, of what you're doing?
Yeah, exactly. So you're no longer, and don't get me wrong, the guy, I mean, he did some fantastic work, but as they've reevaluated it, you know, it, and some of his opinions, they're, you know, they're very desirable things to say, but whether they were based and backed on the scientific method is, you know, uncertain.
And I think that goes back to what you said, that all the, everything needs to be constantly reevaluated. You know, it's not definite. It's not definitive once it's been published. It's,
and that's the inherent problem. That's the balancing act with science, to get philosophical a bit, is you always have uncertainty, but that doesn't mean it's not the best available answer. You know, if you think the alternative has more certainty, which is what some random person read on the internet, you know, then you're probably going to be misguided. But to think science is an absolute is also a bit unfortunate. That's probably not the best worldview to have.
So just speaking about random things you read about on the internet, how do you feel about President Trump and his view on climate change?
So U.S. politics are divided right now. And I think President Trump is going a bit too far. But I also think the former president, Obama, did do some things or allow some things. I mean, he didn't personally do it, that are also questionable. And what I'd like to see is to find a more common ground, moderate, middle area. And I personally can't vote either party right now, because they have things I totally disagree with. But that said, I don't want people to think there's not a reason that Trump won the election. I mean, the people that voted for him are not evil, mean people. You know, half of the United States is not that way. So I hope he sticks to the data. I hope he doesn't do what some of the people that voted for him wanted. And I'm afraid that he could go down a bad path, but I'm trying to be optimistic. Regarding my own issue, climate change, I think he did something that I think Obama would have liked to have done, but Obama didn't have political alignment, and we'll see if Trump can even get it. But one of the things I'm a big fan of, actually, is a carbon tax in the U.S. And there are some silver linings in this plan that he's got. And I think the way it works is, so you would tax carbon, i.e. let's say gasoline or petrol, you guys call it here. And you take that money and you use it to either pay down our ever-growing federal debt, or you could do something like build mass transportation, something that helps people across the spectrum. And so you're in essence taxing excess, because certainly the U.S. is an excessive consumer of fossil fuels, and you're using that to increase efficiency. And I was surprised that he did that. I mean, that's why, as I understand it, and I'm not a political expert, let's be clear here, but I think that's why Elon Musk and Tesla are kind of coming on board with Trump, is because he's proposing, or his administration is considering, a carbon tax. And that would obviously be good for electric cars and such.
And that also goes back to things that were mentioned in COP21, COP22, you know, putting carbon taxes on the rich countries, on the ones that have are emitting the most, I suppose. So I guess not all is bad with Trump as he's being painted out to be.
Well, unless, I mean...
I said not all.
Exactly. I mean, to take the flip side is there is this undertone with him of I don't care what the data says.
Mm-hmm.
And that's frustrating. I see that in several things. And I hope that doesn't define his practice or his policy.
Well, you know, it's tough because, like, I just read an article last week which said the man tipped as his front runner for the role of science advisor, William Happer. He's a physicist at Princeton University. So he has described climate scientists as a glassy-eyed cult in the throes of a form of collective madness.
Well,
see, when you read things like that.
Yeah. Well, that certainly sounds a bit extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've actually heard this guy talk. And there are actually several physicists who are skeptics right now of some of the aspects of climate research.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's important to know, though, is it's kind of a straw man to say they're a skeptic of the foundations, right? I think 97% or whatever of scientists agree that man is increasing CO2. CO2 causes global warming.
Yeah.
That fundamental link is based on physics and well established. I think what happens, though, is the ego of some of the people in the field rubs people the wrong way because they abuse the data a bit and they make this extreme story.
You mean climate scientists?
Climate scientists themselves. And then regarding those people, yes, they exist in climate science. Absolutely. Do they need a counterforce? I'm all about balance, right? And if this guy balances them, that's great. Now, at the same time, it's that merchant of doubt again. Just because there's uncertainty or there's a group that are maybe extreme, almost have turned science into their religion of environmentalism or something, and are willing to say things that maybe aren't supported by data, just because that group may exist does not mean that you throw the whole story out. I mean, you certainly – I'm the ignorant one here on politics. So I think the thing people don't maybe appreciate is as a climate scientist, I have a niche. I can't go too far out of my niche or I become less informed, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the caveats of the models and the nuances of this or that field. But in general, I do think there's a bias towards exaggerating some of the outcomes of global warming. And this can rub people the wrong way who are a physicist, a Nobel Prize winning physicist. There are several, actually, who are skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to have skeptics. I actually think skeptics are a good thing. Now, when you put them in political positions...
That is the problem, I think.
That can be a challenge.
I'm sorry to put you in a spot. You know, it's just I always attack my American guests to find out how they feel about their new president.
Well, I think the core of the Trump support has to do with a counter to a long-term trend of losing opportunity for jobs in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's missed, that because neither party, and I'm not going to blame the left or the right or the Democrats or Republicans here, addressed some of these fundamental things of the average person. I mean, as much as we want to think everyone will be educated and have these high-tech jobs, that's not always true.
Yep.
That's not really... In a lot of parts of the world, that's not going to happen. And these people represent a big chunk of the U.S. population. And to discredit all of them as absurd and not having a reason to feel this,
mm-hmm.
I think you're really missing the boat. I think there's something to learn by this. And both parties can improve by understanding this really did happen. And this didn't happen. I mean, you can't throw that many people, as voted for him as saying they don't have a reason for it. So hopefully what this does is helps redefine both parties. And like I said, I'd like to meet somewhere in the middle. But I think it's interesting. One of the most intelligent president candidates that we had was Mitt Romney. He was a beautiful moderate. I really liked him. I really did. And he actually invented Obamacare. That's one thing. Yeah. When he was governor of Massachusetts, he and his team put that together. And he's a – I mean, don't get me wrong. Some of his business's practices are aggressive and that kind of thing. But it's what we were talking about earlier. Maybe he wasn't the best communicator. And he had no chance, you know, against a marketing juggernaut who, I mean, is smooth talking. I mean, Obama is without a doubt the coolest president we've had. But you also have to look at both sides of Obama. I mean, our historical federal debt doubled almost. I mean, really, really close to doubled under Obama's tenure. You know, we have a lot more debt now than we've ever had. A lot of people that doesn't feel right to. So it's easy to have fun and, you know, I mean, I think our student loan debt is now $1.2 trillion. Mm-hmm. Think about that number. I think about $800 billion came in the 8 years of Obama. So, yeah, you appease people if you're just giving them money to go to school, you know, but that may not be long-term sustainable. And I think that was another thing that people don't see both sides of. For me, it's not that I support Trump, but I do like to see both parties have some say-so because you need that long-term sustainability for all subjects. And economically, I think the Republicans are more sustainable, but I think environmentally and things, the Democrats are more sustainable. So, you know, I don't know.
We'll have to see.
Yeah, it's... It's tough.
It's
I'm an optimist that maybe Trump will do something good, even if he's only there 4 years. But people are like, if he does mess something up, we have so many checks and balances in the U.S. in our system. I don't think he could mess something up so bad. Hopefully a war or anything won't break out. But
yeah,
he doesn't have the political experience.
So just to conclude, you're going to be speaking at the TEDx Youth at KL 2017 event this weekend, and the theme is what now? Well, it's kind of a lot of what we've been talking about, but can you tell me a bit more about what are your areas of discussion for TEDx?
Yeah, so TEDx, I think the theme of my talk is being a skeptic of everything in life and the importance of skeptics in science, but also that they have to stay within a set rules that you don't go far from the data. And what I mean by that is, you know, to be a scientific skeptic, you have to be supported by actual data and evidence.
Yeah.
And then that you see the bigger picture. You can't focus on just a little subset of the data. And then that your opinions don't go too far from what exists, right? So to be a skeptic, you're kind of always in this position. But I think in today's age of mass communication and mass media and social media, it's really important that people understand you need to evaluate everything you read.
Post-truth. We're living in the age of post-truth, as they say.
Right. So I'm using myself as an example, mm-hmm. and then I want to go back and touch some things from my PhD where what I basically did was used 5 million years ago as an analogy for the outcome of global warming. And I want to talk about some of the caveats I learned from that and how it relates to today's climate change issue. And hopefully people can see that being a skeptic and realizing there's more to the story than sometimes the mainstream media presents and that you have to dig a little deeper. So that's what I'm after. So what next is hopefully people dig deeper.
Thank you so much, Aaron. That was Dr. Aaron Shunk, a biologist and geologist and co-founder of the online forum Publici. If you'd like to meet Aaron, you can head over to the TEDx Youth at KL 2017 event, which is happening on Saturday, the 25th of February at EX8 Auditorium, located at number 3, Jalan SS13/4, Subang Jaya Industrial Estate. Pre-event ticket prices are 63 ringgit and 60 cents if you enter the promo code WhatNowBFM. Or if you'd like a t-shirt along with the ticket and other goodies, you can get your ticket at 84 ringgit and 80 cents, again with the promo code WhatNowBFM. So that's WHATNOWBFM in a single word. For more information, you can also visit TEDxYouthKL.com. This has been Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.